Hi everyone, it's Dr. Goyle here from Peak Human Labs, and today I'm doing a podcast at my house because it's an evening day, and but I thought this was so important. I'm here with my close friend Neeraj Jain, and we're just going to talk about intermittent fasting today. Everything you need to know about that, what the latest science is. So yeah, welcome Neeraj. How are you?
Good, Sanjeev, how are you?
Good, good. So we did do I think a short video on caloric restriction. I think it was with the calorie study at some point in the past. But I thought let's talk about intermittent fasting today, because that's a whole other area. I have patients asking me about that all the time, like how should I be doing the intermittent fasting, what the benefits are. So I kind of did a literature review. And maybe let's go through it for our viewers, and good to have your kind of guide on it. That'd be great.
Well, okay, so before we start, let's clear up some terms, right?
Yeah.
Is there a difference between intermittent fasting and time-restricted eating?
Yeah, no, there is. And so I guess the fasting just means any type of restriction for a certain amount of time. But traditionally, is normally meant fasting, fasting, intermittent fasting is normally meant more than 24 hours. Generally, that has been kind of the way of thinking. But time-restricted feeding is generally less than 24 hours. So when we talk, most people are talking about this, 16 hours of fasting, 8 hours of eating, which is 16-8. That's called time-restricted feeding, TRF. Whereas, generally fasting has been done, what's called alternate day fasting, which is one day of regular eating and one day of fasting, ADF, or every other day fasting, EODF. That's another type of mnemonic for that. And then the third type is something called the 5-2, which basically means fasting 2 days a week with 5 days of regular eating. So there's Let's just say there's three main different types of fasting, of which the shorter one is called time-restricted feeding.
Yeah, I mean, so it's there's nothing really significantly different except for the periods of when, like how long the period of fasting is. That's kind of what changes the name.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And it probably has impacts. There are probably metabolic differences between these things, because the amount of fasting does potential, length of fasting probably does make a difference in
Oh,
how, what type of
well, actually,
benefits there
let's
are.
talk about that.
Yeah.
Based on the most recent study that actually just came out this last week, is there a difference? Like, is there a preferred way to achieve? Really, I think we're talking about longevity and increasing our health, right? We're not talking about losing weight.
Yeah, but losing weight does have beneficial effects as well. But the I guess we should take a step back. Like, what's happening in this time-restricted feeding or fasting? What exactly is happening in the body? Is that the body's starting to utilize fatty acids as fuel? So we call fat for fuel rather than glycogen. So normally, what's happening is that when you're eating during the daytime, you're building up glycogen stores in your muscles and in your liver. And so, about 12 hours after no eating, you deplete your glycogen stores, and then your body starts to use free fatty acids as fuel. Those free fatty acids get broken down into beta hydroxybutyrate, which is one of those ketones, and then those ketone bodies can then be broken down by what's called the Krebs cycle into acetyl-CoA. Acetyl-CoA is, the start of the Krebs cycle, and then energy is created from that. So, normally we're all operating in kind of the glucose, sugar, energy system, and fasting kind of allows us to move into this using a different fuel source for energy supplies.
So what's the benefit of that? Why do we
Yeah.
want to do that?
Well, it looks like by basically being in using free fatty acids, it seems to have a lot of benefits on the metabolism. For example, by the humans and rodents that were these mostly these animals were done showed that they ended up having decreased amounts of chronic diseases, so type 2 diabetes, heart disease, they had improved brain function, and they also obviously had weight loss and less fat deposition in the body. So, you know, one of the major issues where fat is accumulating viscerally, so around the organs, including the liver. And so when the body's able to use fat, for your fatty acids, that's in effect breaking down your fat stores and allowing it to be used for energy.
How do you distinguish this from just essentially eating less, right? Because if we're talking about weight loss, obviously that's going to lead to some good health outcomes for, for most people. But someone like me, I really can't afford to lose a lot of weight, or I don't want to lose weight. Would fasting still help someone like me, or is it really for people that need to lose some weight?
It seems like it doesn't just have weight loss benefits. Like it seems to have other benefits as well. Like it improves, lowering the amount of inflammation in the body. It changes white adipose tissue, which is, you know, WAT, to brown adipose tissue called BAT. It has, you know, obviously improvements in the cholesterol profile. So it has a lot of other benefits than just losing weight. And even when you're fasting, it doesn't necessarily mean that you are eating less calories. It could happen, and it frequently does, but it doesn't have to be that way. So just the fact of eating, of giving a kind of a break of eating, has all these other metabolic benefits.
Well, I guess the reason I was asking is, in these studies, they find that all the participants lost weight. And if so, how do they distinguish that, the benefits that come from losing weight versus the benefits that may come from fasting alone and not losing weight? Just curious.
It's kind of hard for people to tease that out. I'm not aware of the study that's really done that. Because most people tend to generally eat less calories when they are doing it, the time restricted feeding, at least, because it's difficult to feed all those calories in.
Right.
But it seems that it has, just the fact of the restricting according to the circadian rhythms seems to have other beneficial effects beyond weight loss.
What did you find when you read this? What were some of the interesting?
The other things that, we talk about this, losing weight, but it's not only a losing weight. I think it's interesting for this whole idea of improving insulin sensitivity. So basically, again, by allowing your body to switch over, we call this the metabolic switch, so being flexible, being able to switch over and use fat stores for energy, your body becomes better at that. And then it doesn't always rely on insulin to take up sugar within your cells. So right now, insulin is the main hormone that every time you eat food, protein and carbs, the cells require that insulin to bring sugar into the cell for energy. But when you're giving a break by fasting or being on a ketone-based diet, like a ketosis diet, your insulin levels are basically at zero. So it allows your body to be more receptive to that insulin, and so that way you don't need as high an insulin level, because insulin has, constantly being at higher levels of insulin does lead to diabetes. Okay. So, and does lead to fatty liver. So it's good to have that kind of flexibility. So that's one of the important things that I think it's important for people to realize. The other thing is that brain health it seems to have a really positive effect on brain health, because we now know that a lot of the neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's are related to inflammation. And again, there's kind of like excitotoxicity, means that a lot of reaction going on. So by being in a ketosis or cutting down those carb intake, they showed that there was a reduction in inflammation. It improved patients who had Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, there was less brain injury. It seemed like, you know, there was lots of benefits for these type of chronic neurological illnesses.
That's interesting. So someone that is, say, showing early signs of, say, dementia or something, should they go on to a low-carb diet or maybe even consider fasting?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think there's quite a bit of benefit now that to doing that. And I think on a previous podcast, I've talked about even the science of using these ketone drinks for people who have Alzheimer's. And it seems like, again, these, what ends up happening in these types of illnesses is that they have a problem using sugar, taking sugar up into their cells, and they end up with like an energy deficit. Like they're having difficulty to get energy from carbohydrates. So the brain is one of those few organs that can use ketones for energy. So it can, you know, it can cross the blood-brain barrier, these ketone bodies. And so it's really an alternate fuel source, and again, doesn't cause that type of inflammation. You'll see that even in, you know, where it's already being used for people have epileptic disorders, ketone-based diets or fasting has been shown to be helpful as well.
Interesting. Okay. Anything else that you found interesting?
Yeah, I think so the whole part about about the brain health is really important. Then there's the whole, I did talk, you know, somewhat about cardiovascular health. So like I said, it improves the lipid parameters, so decreasing LDL, improving HDL, decreasing triglyceride levels, decreasing inflammation, C-reactive protein. All of this has been shown to be improved with intermittent fasting.
Okay, so again, I want to just clarify. So is this any kind of intermittent fasting, or were there certain protocols that worked better or some that didn't work at all?
It looked like a lot of studies were done on alternate day fasting, but though there definitely has been studies on the time restricted feeding as well, especially on sugar metabolism as well.
So are you recommending to your patients to do any of these protocols?
Yeah, I recommend my patients to, you know, I don't think one needs to be very strict about the number of hours. So, you know, this thing about 16 hours, I think it's very difficult for people to do. I think if long as you can try to hit 12 hours, you're going to get the benefits. Because like I said, after 12 hours, your glycogen stores have depleted. So you start to enter into ketosis. And yeah, probably it's not an all or nothing thing. I think what probably happens is that as your stores are being depleted, your body starts to use both sources of energy. It probably uses some amount of free fatty acids for energy and some carbs. And as carbs deplete, you move more into using free fatty acids as energy sources. So probably it's a gradual conversion. And like I said, some people are better than that than others. And it's kind of like, it's like exercise, I think. The more you kind of train your body to make that switch, then your body can make it quicker without you having, you know, headaches or feeling unwell or feeling sick or whatever. So, I think, you know, 12 hours would be good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, when I first started sort of a little, you know, some time-restricted eating, before that, I used to, as soon as I woke up, I was starving. Right. And I needed to eat, you know, almost within 15 minutes of waking up. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I heard about people skipping breakfast, I couldn't understand it. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, I sort of trained myself to push my breakfast later and later. And so, initially I found it was difficult, but it got easier and easier. So you're saying I actually trained my body, like it developed the flexibility to do that.
Yeah, exactly. I think, and you know, there's that initial hormones that are released to say that you're hungry, and they probably after some time you don't have that huge spike of hormones telling you that you need to eat right away, and your body becomes kind of more used to that, having that fasting. So you know, you hear about people who have this, you know, hypoglycemia as soon as they're like stop eating, and then what's probably happening is they're having an overshoot of insulin. So as soon as they're eating, they have an overshoot of insulin, and if they don't keep eating, their sugars drop because they just produce so much insulin, like they're in a hyperinsulinemia. Yeah, which is, you know, a risk factor for diabetes. So before you become before your sugar levels go high, you probably have this kind of up and down seesaw of sugar levels, very high, low, that type of thing. And that low and high kind of makes you, makes things that you kind of feel more hungry up and down to match that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're recommending that people at least do a 12-hour window of eating or 12 hours of not eating, and if possible, maybe extend the not eating period up to 16.
Although yeah, I think that's what you're going to do, the daily, time-restricted feeding. And, I even believe that one shouldn't even do this every day. You don't need to do this every single day. If you do it 2 days or 3 days a week, that's great. It all depends what your kind of baseline is. If you already have a pretty good metabolism and you're doing well, you don't need to necessarily do it all the time. Okay. What might be more helpful is the alternate day fasting, or actually fasting for 2 or 3 days straight. Because it's after, 2.5 days that you start to get some of the real benefits of ketosis, and then you have this increase in stem cells that happens around after 2.5 days of fasting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess the alternate day fasting wouldn't let you get to that level.
No.
You're better off to do the 5-2.
Yeah, that's why the 5-2, but it's just harder. But alternate day might be easier. It's only 24 hours. It's possible.
I think what I'm understanding from you is if the first 12 hours gives you some benefits, mm-hmm. and then there may be other benefits that kick in at different points of the fasting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I think, I think people should start somewhere with a lower amount so they can kind of get through it, and then slowly increase that amount. And like you said, it gets easier. And normally that first day is the hardest, and then it just gets easier as time goes on.
Mm-hmm. Are there any, are there people that shouldn't do this?
I think if you're underweight, because even though, it's not really meant to be a weight loss issue, but, generally people will eat less calories because it's hard to get all the calories in. So if you're underweight, you're pregnant, maybe if you're elderly, because if you don't have a lot of body mass on you, then those are maybe not reasons to not do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are there any downsides to doing this other than potentially losing weight?
No, I don't think so. I think it looks like it's pretty positive. It looks like that's what our humans were doing, that's what our genetics have been like doing that for, thousands and thousands of years. So probably we're meant to do that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's quite interesting.
There's a whole part about immune function. It seems that immune function improves when there's time-restricted. They basically put mice through time-restricted feeding and found that, they upregulated their immune function. They had more ability to kill off bacteria. It seemed like there's a lot of positive on the immune function as well.
Another question for you. Yeah. Does it matter when you have your eating window? Does it matter if you're eating, for example, from 10 to 6,
mm-hmm.
or noon to 8, or is there anything to add on that?
I couldn't find too much on that. My thought is that it's still probably better to do the fasting in the later part of the evening, because we know that it's got to match the circadian rhythms. And if you end up eating a bit late into the night, like let's say 9 p.m., then it does impact your sleep and your metabolism. That we do know that those people tend to have worse sleep. They end up having problems with their metabolism, with sugar levels that really persist to almost 3 a.m. in the morning.
Oh, wow.
So about 4 or 5 in the morning. I don't know if you've ever worn a LibreView or Dexcom, but you'll see that the blood sugars will remain high if you had any type of meal that's around 9 or 10.
Well, I do know from my Oura Ring that mm-hmm. the days that if I have a late dinner, my sleep score is generally lower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And did you notice any type of any effect on what type of food, or does it matter.
I mean, generally, if I'm eating late, it's going to be some kind of party food.
Yeah.
It tends to be a little heavier.
Yeah.
There's dessert involved, alcohol. Mm. So there's a bunch of things there.
Yeah, yeah. So there was a whole bunch. How did people are wondering why does this have that impact? Like, we didn't really talk about mechanisms, but it looks like it could be because it's kind of working in sync with our own circadian rhythms, you know, we're probably meant to eat during the daytime and not eat in the nighttime. And so if you are doing time restricted feeding, you are, you know, more in your biological rhythm. And so that's probably one of the reasons why it's working. Second thing that they think is that it could be impacting the bacteria of the gut. And what's happening is that when they start giving food at different times of the day, the type of bacteria changes in the gut, and which produce different type of metabolites. Some of these are more correlated with obesity. And so it seems like, you know, that the whole microbiome is a whole other aspect that really it's unknown. I mean, it's still people are learning about it, but this idea about the metabolites that these bacteria are producing seem to be very important. The other thing is this, the effect of these metabolites on the white adipose tissue and how it converts over to brown adipose tissue. That's another factor as well. So there's a lot of signaling happening, and this is being mediated by the bacteria. And so what time you eat does make a difference. After that, it seems like the autophagy, the whole idea of autophagy, is really important. So autophagy just means to self-eat. And when you're fasting, you're basically activating pathways that increase autophagy. That again will lead to signaling, improved metabolism signaling, and conversion of the white adipose tissue to brown adipose tissue. So that's,
you're clearing away the dead cells that are not really functioning that well.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, because so what's happening is that they're also removing lipids and other types of fats, like breakdowns. You're right, breakdown products. If you're not doing that, it's gonna lead to increase lipids in your blood. Mm-hmm. So I hope it's a good summary here. Putting it all together, fasting has so many effects on multiple parts of the body. It seems like it's, you know, beneficial in the heart, brain. We did talk about liver fat, so fatty liver disease, weight loss. So that does improve that. I don't know if I mentioned it. It seems like it may also have impact to reset the reproductive system. And they've shown in animals that these mice release more follicles when they're in fasting stage. Maybe again, these may have some type of evolutionary benefit.
Yeah, it almost sounds like this is the way we were meant to be. Mm-hmm. And the way we are now, where we're eating for longer periods, it's not that fasting is giving us a benefit. It's just eating all the time is messing us up.
That's what it is. It's not, this is more like just a natural part of being.
Instead of saying that, oh, we're getting better, we're just not getting worse.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah, I think it's...
Because it seems to impact the whole body, right? Like you said, the heart, the liver, the brain, reproductive systems.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite dramatic.
Yeah, we've kind of, you know, thought, oh, fasting is about weight loss or whatever. It seems like it has so many benefits. And, I didn't touch on it too much, but, the mice have shown, you know, benefits of living 40% longer. So again, we don't know what happens in humans because no one's been able to do a study looking at longevity in humans, but it's probably be even more powerful than caloric restriction.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, if all those functions, like your heart is running better, your liver's running better, all that's, chances are you'll have less disease, so you should live longer.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that the authors kind of pointed out was that we think about caloric restriction, we think, oh, you're going to live longer, but by just eating less calories, you may be actually slowing down your metabolism. Your body's making adjustments to eating, living with less calories. You're not going to necessarily put on so much muscle, or you may, might be in a catabolic state. And that's not necessarily a good long-term strategy, right? Like, whereas if you're eating, like, you're eating a good amount and then you're fasting, but then at the whole, you're still eating a good number of calories, but you're still able to grow when you need to grow and get rid of when you need to get rid of. That sounds to me like a much better strategy for longevity.
Well, it seems a little more enjoyable than caloric restriction.
Yeah.
Caloric restriction honestly doesn't feel natural, right? This actually sounds quite natural that you eat for a window and then you rest. And I would imagine our, great ancestors probably not eating after sunset.
Yeah, no, that's it. I think this is probably how we're meant to be. Just how do we get that? How do we now may put those tools in place for people to do that these days? It's so difficult, but it sounds like the science is there. It's really looking good now.
Awesome.
Yeah, so I hope this was helpful. I really appreciate it. Anybody's got any questions, comment, like and subscribe on our channel, and we'll talk to you next time.
All right, take care.
Okay.